the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Billahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Is an end to in sight to Sudan's political crisis? That question as military rulers agree to reinstate the ousted premier after weeks of protests. Injuries as a third day of protests against the French army in Burkina Faso turns violent. In anger and protests rising in Europe over COVID restrictions, with the Netherlands gripped by fiery riots for a second night. Welcome to the program. A big story we're following today, a major development now unfolding in Sudan's politics. The military is to reinstate ousted Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok following an agreement reached with civilian leaders. National Ummah Party says that Hamdok will form a cabinet of technocrats and that all political detainees will be released. The development comes as on the heels of weeks-long protests to demand the return of a civil government. The country was thrust into chaos after top general Abdel Fattah al-Burhan toppled the transitional government late last month and detained civilian leaders, including the prime minister. At least four anti-coup protesters have been killed since then. Military takeover as well as the deadly crackdowns have received widespread condemnations, including from the African Union. Of course, we're going to be following that story for perhaps updates. At least four protesters are wounded elsewhere in Africa, in fact in Burkina Faso, during the third day of demonstrations against the French army. Violence broke out in the town of Kaya when French and Burkinabe forces tried to break the protesters' blockade on a French military convoy heading for Niger. It was not immediately clear which side opened fire on the demonstrators. The protesters accuse French forces of working with armed groups and demand the removal of the foreign forces from their country. They say militant attacks increase whenever a French military convoy passes through Burkina Faso. Third headline story, and scuffles break out in the Netherlands as protests against the government's new coronavirus restrictions continue for the second consecutive night. Latest footage shows clashes between police and protesters in The Hague. Thousands of people also took to the streets of the capital, Amsterdam, despite the strong presence of security forces. This follows an outbreak of violence on Friday night in Rotterdam. Three people were injured there after police fired shots and water cannons to disperse angry demonstrators. Dozens of people were also arrested. Similar anti-lockdown protests were also held in other European countries on Saturday, including Denmark, Croatia, and Austria.
Tens of thousands take to the streets of the Austrian capital ahead of the nation's fourth general lockdown, affecting the vaccinated and unvaccinated alike.
This is just one of several rallies taking place across the city just the day after the government announced that vaccinations will become mandatory from February.
Around 2 million of the country's 9 million residents have refused to get vaccinated.
I've not been vaccinated, and I believe this is a bluff on the part of the government. They want to put people under pressure. When vaccination becomes mandatory, I will stay at home. I believe everyone should be able to make their own choice.
I'm here because I'm against the vaccination for everybody. I want to decide myself. It's my body, and so I don't want to tell anyone to me that I have to go to vaccination.
The federal government has blamed the right-wing opposition Freedom Party, the FPÖ, for fueling public anger at a time of national crisis. Police forces confirmed that right-wing extremists, including convicted neo-Nazis, had taken part in the rallies, which remained largely peaceful, despite several instances of clashes and arrests. Austria is now reporting well over 15,000 new infections a day, with the total death toll almost reaching 12,000 people. Health experts say without compulsory vaccinations, the country will only stumble into new lockdowns every 3 or 4 months. Omaleski, Vienna.
Political commentator Lajos Ajdi says European governments have to restrict their people's liberty due to the coronavirus pandemic. Take a listen.
It's a matter of a new variant of the virus that is evolving, and then you have to combine somehow juggle between liberties and the need of people to go out and go to a restaurant, especially now that Christmas is coming. But then there are other problems like winter, that because of the cold weather, probably this virus is going to, some people say that if the virus comes from a certain kind of weather, then the opposite kind of weather is going to be, I'm not a biologist, but a cold weather might make people stay indoors, stay home, but then, I don't know, that could be like a source of incubation for the virus. In any case, the thing is
keep the windows closed.
There's like a baseline. People got to get vaccinated. People got to continue with social distancing. People got to use masks. And if you have relaxation, so people are not that careful, I mean, those that haven't vaccinated themselves at all, or they only have one vaccine, that is the problem. And that's the argument in the United States, that they say that there's like 30% people that haven't vaccinated, and the amount of deaths, the increases are in that kind of the population. So it's difficult. It's difficult when you and people want liberty, freedoms, but at the same time, governments have to take this as a public a health measure, a matter of life and death. So it's quite difficult. Yes.
The World Health Organization expresses concern over the rising COVID-19 figures across Europe. The agency has warned that some 500,000 people could die by March of next year unless urgent action is taken to stem the spread of the virus. The WHO believes impending winter season, low vaccination rates, and the faster-spreading Delta variant of the virus contribute to the surge. The warning comes as several European nations have posted record caseloads and announced partial or full lockdowns. The International Organization for Migration says the situation still remains tough for migrants stranded on the border between Belarus and Poland. The organization's chief of mission in Belarus says the migrants still have no access to basic living standards, despite an improvement in their conditions. Thousands of migrants have been camping for weeks on the Belarusian side of the border with Poland. They're trying to cross into the European Union, but Poland blocks their entry, Warsaw accuses Minsk of fomenting the crisis, a claim Belarus denies. Minsk started repatriating some of the migrants to Iraq on Thursday. The row over Taiwan now expanding to Europe. China says it's downgrading its diplomatic ties with Lithuania after the Baltic state allowed Taipei to open its de facto embassy in Vilnius. The foreign ministry says Beijing had to lower its ties to safeguard China's sovereignty and the basic norms of international relations. It added that the Lithuanian government must bear all the consequences that arise from this decision. Vilnius has reacted, expressing regret over Beijing's decision. Back in July, Lithuania allowed for the opening of the embassy, Taiwan's first new diplomatic outpost in Europe in 18 years. That prompted both sides to recall their ambassadors. China views Taiwan as part of its territory under what it calls the One China policy. The issue has already soured relations between China and the United States. Fury and reactions in the U.S. over the acquittal of a militia member who shot dead two anti-racism protesters last year. Court verdict that the shootings by Kyle Rittenhouse was in self-defense is triggering a lot of heated debate. There have been protests across several cities. In Chicago, Black Lives Matter protesters turned out carrying signs that read, "White supremacy equals terrorism." Protests also erupted in Tampa, Florida, and Minneapolis, Minnesota. The verdict has raised fierce criticism of the justice system and its preferential treatment of white supremacists. There's also renewed debate over the boundaries of gun rights and self-defense in the U.S. South America, Chile will hold general elections on Sunday to choose the country's next president, lawmakers, and regional council members. Nearly 15 million people are eligible to vote. Seven candidates are vying for the presidency, with recent opinion polls showing two frontrunners. One is Gabriel Boric, a congressman who represents the left-wing coalition and was a leader of the student movement. Another main contender is José Antonio Kast from the far-right Christian Social Front Coalition. He's a lawyer and former congressman. A runoff will be held on December the 9th if none of the candidates obtains an outright majority. Voters will also elect all 155 members of the lower house of Congress, 27 of 50 senators, and regional council representatives. Alejandro Kirk says the upcoming presidential election in Chile is the most uncertain one since 1990.
The mood in Santiago is quiet in the country. There have been no major disturbances nor big demonstrations. Parties seem not to be capable of gathering huge amounts of people. That's part of the process that's been developing since the popular uprising of 2019, October 2019, when whatever is happening now was born in that movement that turned the political spectrum and the institutionality upside down. What's at stake tomorrow is more than just another election. This is the most uncertain election ever since the end of the dictatorship in 1990. The traditional political parties seem to be getting weaker and even disappearing. For example, the Christian Democratic Party, which was one of the most important parties in the history of Chile, now has only one representative in the constitutional convention that was elected this year to draft a new constitution.
Remaining in that part of the world, celebrations, parades, and protests as Brazilians show their disapproval of the government's treatment of the black population. November the 20th marks the Black Awareness Day in Brazil. To honor that occasion, demonstrators turned out across 100 cities. In São Paulo, they chanted slogans against President Jair Bolsonaro and even called for him to quit. The demonstrators believe Bolsonaro's government is violating the black lives, or the black people's rights, I should say. Brazilian blacks lag behind the rest of the population in terms of employment, education, and political representation. That's according to the country's own official statistics. The Yemeni army has announced a large-scale military operation deep into Saudi territory in response to the kingdom's escalating attacks against the impoverished country. The Yemeni army spokesman says 14 drones were used in the retaliatory attack against targets across Saudi Arabia. Yahya Sari said the King Khalid base was struck in Riyadh, while King Abdullah International Airport and Aramco oil facilities were targeted in Jeddah. He added that military targets were also hit in the kingdom's Abha, Jizan, and Najran regions. Meanwhile, the Saudi-led coalition said it has carried out a major offensive in Yemen, targeting 13 areas in Sana'a, Sa'ada, and Ma'arib. Saudi Arabia has recently ramped up its war on Yemen, which it launched back in March of 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed and millions more displaced since then. Yemeni activist and political commentator Hussein Al-Bukhaiti earlier joined us from Sana'a to discuss the latest retaliatory operations by Yemeni forces. He believes that more such attacks can put an end to the Saudi war on Yemen. Take a listen.
And to show you that the Yemeni army has actually carried out attacks that have reached most of the Saudi land. That's why I think that this latest attack, it will, if we continue, if Sana'a continue this type of attack, I think that the war will come to an end. But if we continue to target after Saudi continuous attack and blockade on Yemen, I think that the Saudi actually will continue their war. That's why Yemeni army should keep targeting Saudi Arabia, and I think they must at this point repeat the attack against Aramco oil field like they did 2 or 3 years ago against Baqiq and Khurais in Saudi Arabia. Because if we have seen how many times those airports, especially Abha and Najran and Jizan, has come under Yemeni attack, but still Saudi still actually did not stop its war against Yemen. That's why many lives are lost every day, not only by the Saudi airstrike, but as well by the Saudi blockade, which has been tightened more since Biden has reached the White House. And I believe that Yemeni army is capable not only to launch 14 drones at once. I'm sure that in the coming days or weeks, we're going to see some strategic attack against Saudi Arabia involving tens or 20 to 50 drones and ballistic missiles.
Families of missing people in Pakistan have once again slammed the government for what they call its lack of seriousness to recover their loved ones. Muhammad Turi explains from Karachi.
Rights groups and families of missing persons held a press conference in Karachi to once again voice their grave concerns over the non-recovery of their loved ones, slamming the government for its lack of seriousness in their recovery. Last Saturday, families of Shia missing persons changed their direction towards military offices known to be the real powerhouses in Pakistan. Victims' families are outraged over the law enforcement agencies who they now accuse for clamping down on their right to protest. They are calling on the government to prosecute those responsible for abduction of their loved ones in the court of law. The family says state institutions are open for talks with Takfiri terrorists who have killed over 70,000 Pakistanis but are not serious to recover missing persons. The first post 9/11 reported case of enforced disappearances was Dr. Afia, who was kidnapped from Karachi along with her three kids in 2003. Enforced disappearances is a chronic human rights violation in Pakistan, with more than 7,000 complaints of enforced disappearances since 2011. Where the real number might be much higher than the official figure. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
in the limelight.
The latest resolution of the United Nations General Assembly on the rights of Palestinians living in their Zionist usurped homeland, although welcomed by all those sympathetic to the plight of a long oppressed nation, is not expected to force the Israeli regime to honor it, let alone implement its clauses, says Sayed Ali Shahbaz, writer, in an article published under the heading Toothless UN Resolutions, No Solution for Palestinian Plight. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The latest resolution of the United Nations General Assembly on the rights of Palestinians living in their Zionist usurped homeland, although welcomed by all those sympathetic to the plight of a long oppressed nation, is not expected to force the Israeli regime to honor it, let alone implement its clauses. It was passed at the Economic and Financial Committee of the UN General Assembly, known as the Second Committee, with an overwhelming majority of 157 member states endorsing it, while 14, mostly European states, abstaining from voting, and a mere 7, including the United States and Canada, as the main accomplices of the Zionist regime's crimes against humanity, casting negative votes. Entitled Permanent Sovereignty of the Palestinian People in the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including East Al-Quds, and of the Arab population in the occupied Syrian Golan over their natural resources, it is not more than one of those theoretical shows of support that are practically without any teeth. It should be recalled that a much more serious stand on the chronic question of Palestine taken by the world body on December 23, 2016, and at that time by the Security Council, whose resolution 2334 called on world countries to distinguish in their dealings between the Israeli communities and Palestinian lands occupied by the Zionist regime, has continued to be totally ignored. It not only did not make many world countries, especially those in the U.S. camp, from complying with its clauses, but also failed to prevent certain Arab regimes from committing treason against the Palestinians by establishing full diplomatic ties with the usurper Israel, to the extent that Bahraini officials were seen assisting Zionist thugs in attacking Palestinian worshippers in the sacred precincts of the Al-Aqsa Mosque a couple of months ago. Moreover, the unanimously approved UN Security Council Resolution 242 that was adopted on November 22, 1967, calling for withdrawal of Israeli regime forces from all territories occupied in the June 1967 war, including Syria's Golan Heights, lies dormant for the past 54 years. So, what is the purpose of these UN resolutions that claim to support the just cause of the Palestinian people with beautiful words and phrases, but instead of forcing the Zionist entity to respect the international law, have actually emboldened it in seizing more Palestinian lands and further trampling upon their rights? Nothing other than lulling sympathizers of the Palestinian people into slumber, while giving the tacit nod to the Israeli regime to annex the Golan Heights, destroy farmlands, and evict Palestinians from their homes in eastern Al-Quds to build townships for the illegal Jewish immigrants, erect the apartheid wall to splinter the West Bank into several unconnected pieces and continue the siege of Gaza with frequent air raids and missile attacks to kill men, women, and children. The fact cannot be denied that the blind support of Godfather U.S., the world's topmost terrorist state, has made illegitimate Israel more impudent in committing every crime against the people of Palestine, Lebanon, Syria. Thus, the solution to the plight of the Palestinian people is not any toothless UN resolution, but either a referendum involving all indigenous inhabitants, including Muslims, Jews, and Christians, for a single state, or an armed struggle to liberate the usurped land.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The United States is appealing a British judge's decision not to extradite Julian Assange, the Australian journalist and founder of WikiLeaks. In January, Judge Baretzer found that U.S. prison conditions would be too oppressive and that Assange would be likely to take his own life. In response, the United States has taken to the High Court to contest her findings about Assange's health. In addition, the United States has offered up diplomatic assurances, saying that it won't put Assange in oppressive prison conditions, which doctors have said would lead to suicide. So what exactly are these diplomatic assurances that the United States has offered, and can they actually be trusted? How come Assange's health is the center of the discussion when scores of legal experts, academics, journalists, and historians have all warned that this indictment currently poses the biggest threat to press freedoms? To answer these questions, I attended the court proceedings remotely as they unfolded in London's High Court, and this is what I saw. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. High Court appeal took place on October 27 and 28 of 2021, lasting just 2 days. The United States is appealing Judge Bretz's decision not to extradite Julian Assange on 5 grounds. These 5 grounds can be summed up in 2 topics. Number 1, Assange's health, and number 2, the diplomatic assurances. We'll deal first with Assange's health. As we've mentioned before, Judge Baretzer blocked Assange's extradition to the U.S., namely on health grounds. So what has the United States responded? Well, the U.S. lawyers argue that she erred in her judgment, that she didn't apply the test correctly, that Assange doesn't meet the criteria for his extradition to be oppressive. They accuse him of essentially being a malingerer, someone who's pretending to be sick. Professor Michael Kupperman is the lead medical expert for the defense. Kupperman's testimony is very important because the judge relied heavily on it to block the extradition. She said that she preferred his testimony because his notes were more detailed than the other doctors. Kupperman also spent the most time with Assange. So because Kupperman's testimony is so crucial for the defense, the United States lawyers have tried desperately to discredit both the report and Kupperman. In his first psychiatric report, Kupperman did not disclose the relationship between Julian Assange and Stella Morris, or that they had had 2 children in the Ecuadorian embassy. Although this point has nothing to do with medicine or psychiatry, the United States is exploiting it to accuse Kupperman of misleading the court. They say that his medical evidence should be given little or no weight. Now, Assange's lawyers replied that Kupperman did not conceal anything from the court. He only kept the relationship secret because he was concerned for the privacy and safety of Ms. Morris and her children. This happened right around the time when we were finding out about Assange being spied on in the Ecuadorian embassy, among other things. In her ruling, Judge Bretzer did say that she found this behavior from Kupperman misleading and inappropriate, but an understandable human response to Ms. Morris' predicament. The lead prosecutor for the United States, James Lewis, accuses Assange of being a malingerer trying to avoid extradition. In the High Court, Lewis said that, quote, if he's clever enough, he can get around extradition. It then becomes a trump card which cannot be dealt with by the requesting state, no matter if the prevention matters are 100 times better than in England. The prosecution argued that Assange did not meet the criteria under the Turner test, meaning he must be unable to resist the impulse to commit suicide. Only that could block extradition. Now, Assange's lawyers respond that Professor Kupperman did find this to be the case. Kupperman said that Assange cannot resist the impulse to commit suicide. If he's extradited, he will take his own life. Assange's lawyers also pointed out that there are people who make plans to take their own lives. That's not impulsive, but it's still driven by their mental disorder. And so it's unreasonable, it doesn't make sense, to say that Assange is not suicidal just because he's not impulsively suicidal. Now, the entire appeal hearing at the High Court is, of course, too large to condense into one episode, but nevertheless, it consisted of various accusations from the prosecution that the defense's medical experts were lacking in expertise or integrity. For example, that Kupperman had misled the court, that Dr. Dealey was wrong in his autism diagnosis, and so forth. Now, the other main topic discussed in the High Court was that of diplomatic assurances. The United States has said that if Assange is extradited, it will not place him in special administrative measures, or SAMs, which are some of the worst prison conditions imaginable. The U.S. also says that Assange won't be sent to ADX Florence, one of the worst prisons in the country. Robert Hood, the former warden at ADX Florence, described it as worse than death. The U.S. also claims that Assange could serve a potential sentence in his home country of Australia. In the High Court, I actually saw Lewis say that Assange can't be that suicidal because he can look forward to going to jail in Australia, as if going to jail in one's home country is something that every journalist dreams of. Now, the prosecution claimed that they weren't given a fair chance to offer these assurances before, and had they, the judge would have decided differently. Well, Assange's lawyers point out that this isn't true. They say the United States had many opportunities to offer assurances that Assange won't be placed under SAMs. Instead, the prosecution not only said that SAMs are possible, but that they're okay. They said that Assange can play crochet and write poetry and self-recreate, which essentially means going into an adjacent empty room to spend time by himself. Now, Maureen Baird used to be the warden of a notorious jail in New York, Metropolitan Correctional Center, MCC. She testified at Assange's hearing and described what prison conditions are like in pretrial SAMs. She said that inmates were in solitary confinement, technically for 24 hours a day. There was absolutely no communication by any means with other inmates, and the only form of human interaction they had was when the guards came to inspect their cells or give them food through the slot in the door. Last year, when I was in court at the Old Bailey, I heard anonymous testimony from former employees of UC Global. UC Global is the Spanish firm in charge of security at the Ecuadorian embassy where Assange had been given political asylum. Now, the employees described how the United States got them to spy on Assange by installing cameras and secret microphones, and there were even discussions about physically hurting or kidnapping the WikiLeaks founder. And last week, for the first time, we saw the Yahoo News story brought up in court. Published in September, it has 30 U.S. officials admitting that the CIA was discussing plans to potentially assassinate Assange or kidnap him in London. This corroborated what we already knew from UC Global. Assange's lawyers pointed out that even former CIA Director Mike Pompeo confirmed this to be true. So if the decision to place Assange under SAMS is up to the Attorney General with kind input from the CIA, of course they're going to put him in SAMS. This is the same agency that was discussing maybe killing Assange. It's the same agency whose files he published in 2017 in the Vault 7 leaks. There is no doubt that they will put him in SAMS. Now, Assange's lawyers explained that even if Assange isn't placed in SAMS, which is certain he will be, he can still be put in other oppressive conditions. Mark Summers, Assange's lawyer, said, "You can proceed entirely confident that in the event of surrender to the USA, Julian Assange will enter into administrative segregation, ADSEG, at Alexandria for years." He added that ADSEG is isolation. There is no assurance from the US not to place Assange under ADSEG. All the evidence, including Kronberg's, is that ADSEG is in prospect for Mr. Assange. Assange's lawyer, Mark Summers, added that even if ADX Colorado is off the table, Assange would be sent to a communications management unit, or CMU. It's a prison within a prison, an experiment in social isolation. Correspondence is limited to 1 6-page letter a week to one recipient. And in regards to being sent to Australia, Assange's lawyer argued that, first of all, Australia hasn't even accepted or said yes. And even if it did say yes, who says that future politicians would agree? We have no idea who will be in power in 10 years when this process is actually finished. This is a process that could take a very long time, and Assange would most certainly be in isolation for the entire duration. That isolation would lead him to take his own life, as doctors confirmed to the court. Now, the United States lawyers said that these assurances are solemn undertakings given out at the highest order. These are not dished out like Smarties. Lewis added that the United States has never broken a diplomatic assurance ever. Now, Assange's lawyers don't believe that to be true. They say these assurances can't be trusted because they are worded in a way that binds the prosecutors but not the Department of Justice. So even if Assange is extradited and placed in SAMS and he complains, the Department of Justice can just say, "We never promised you that." Assange's lawyers gave examples of other people who were given false assurances by the U.S. They were extradited, thinking they'd be placed in a medical unit or hospitalized, and then sent instead to ADX. The United States even has a disclaimer in the assurance where it practically admits that Assange will be placed under SAMS. It says very clearly, Mr. Assange will not be subject to SAMS or imprisonment at ADX unless he does something that would warrant to them, like threatening national security. This means they certainly will place him under SAMS because the whole case is built on the false premise that Assange and WikiLeaks endangered national security. Assange's lawyer, Mark Summers, added that even in the event of acquittal in the United States, what Gordon Kronberg could do is summon him before a grand jury, incarcerate him for civil contempt, and place him in a special housing unit. So even if Assange is acquitted, he could still go back to jail. And that's not just a possibility, it's actually a likelihood, because Kronberg did precisely this to Chelsea Manning when she refused to testify against Julian Assange. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
joining me is Kevin Gostola, an American journalist whose work focuses on whistleblower and national security cases. Besides the Assange court hearings, he's also covered the cases of Chelsea Manning, John Kiriakou, Daniel Hale, and others. Kevin is also the managing director of Shadowproof, as well as producer and co-host of the weekly podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure. So, Kevin, given the United States history, what they've done to other prisoners who were also given so-called assurances, not diplomatic ones, but nevertheless, they were misled, weren't they? I mean, if we look at what they did to Daniel Hale just a few months ago, or Chelsea Manning, which you both covered, do you lend these diplomatic assurances any credence above others?
All four of these assurances have significant loopholes. I'll start with the more generic thing that we should really look at, which is the UK government is supposedly the government that would represent Julian Assange's interests if he did not think the US government upheld the assurances that are given by the US government. So in other words, what we see in the United States' argument to the High Court of Justice that we should trust the US government's assurances is that he would have the ability to file some kind of a challenge if he didn't believe that they were being upheld. And he would first go to the UK government, and they would tell the US government that Julian Assange says he isn't getting the medical care he needs, or he believes it's wrong that he's been put in special administrative measures, or that he's in these restrictive solitary conditions in Alexandria Detention Center while waiting to be put on trial. And that is ridiculous, because the UK government, I can't imagine wanting to be any sort of ally of Julian Assange, given what they've done. Well, first off, this isn't really even about the case, but we know from Italian journalist Stefania Merizzi that the UK government has actively fought Freedom of Information Act requests for basic details about what these services in the country, like the Crown Prosecution Service, I think she might have even asked for records from the police department, what they were doing in order to target people who are associates of WikiLeaks, like Kristen Harrafson, who's now the editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks, Joseph Farrell, Sarah Harrison, who, by the way, is an unindicted co-conspirator in the latest indictment in this case, something that is concerning. And so she's asked for these records, and they won't give them to her. And then also... We know that there are records that have been destroyed historically related to the Assange extradition, going back to the Swedish case. But in the last decade, we know that there are records that no longer exist because the government actually destroyed those records. And this is the government we're supposed to believe will advocate for Assange to the U.S. government, that he should not be mistreated and that his human rights should be upheld. It's laughable.
You know, we heard things in court about how Assange could communicate with prisoners above and below through the plumbing. You know, Kronberg insists that ADSEG is not isolation. I mean, what do you think of not just ADSEG, but also the other kinds of hell holes they could put Assange in, right? Because his lawyers pointed out there's a possibility of being sent to a CMU or an SHU. I mean, are these, you know, prisons that different from ADX? You know, having covered Chelsea Manning and Daniel Hale's trials, you know all too well that they have a way of putting these people through enormous suffering, don't they?
Yeah. So let's take Chelsea Manning. She went through untold amounts of suffering for a year in a jail, refusing to cooperate with this grand jury. And toward the end, she attempted suicide yet again. Another time, she had attempted suicide when she was at Fort Leavenworth serving her sentence, her military prison sentence. So again, this put her in a position where she was near a psychotic break, and she attempted suicide, and she did that because of the conditions of her her jailing, her detention, while she was resisting a grand jury subpoena. She didn't know when she was going to be released. She ended up being released a few days after attempting suicide. This happened to her. If it happened to her, it could happen to Julian Assange while he's awaiting trial. This is the same jail that Daniel Hale was sent to while awaiting sentencing. they put him in there because they wanted to make everyone believe that he, his post-traumatic stress that he has from the moral injury of being involved in the drone program was something that was driving him crazy and he was going to do self-harm to himself. His therapist actually ratted him out to pretrial services, and he ended up being thrown in jail and not able to prepare himself for going to prison. You know, do things like find a home for his cat, take care of any bills that he had, outstanding payments, put all of his things in order so that he could then go to prison. Something that a lot of people get to do when they know that they're going to be going off to prison. And they deprived him of his ability to do that. He was just picked up, taken to a jail, and he hasn't been free since. And now he's in a CMU, a communications management unit, and there he is in conditions that, in terms of social visits, it's actually worse than special administrative measures. It's been described as worse by the Center for Constitutional Rights because you do not have contact visits with any individuals who come to see you. So immediate family come, Stella, her children, his children come, Gabriel and Max, and he's on the other side of a partition. There's glass. He speaks, you know, I think he grabs the telephone, think of like the movies where they talk through the glass. He never gets to touch. He never gets to hug. He doesn't get to kiss his kids. They don't get to sit on his lap. He doesn't get to share any moments with them while he is in this facility if he gets sentenced to a CMU.
So besides an SHU or a CMU, I mean, what else could they do? Because ADSEG is pretty much guaranteed. If you ask me, SAMs are also pretty much guaranteed. Do you also feel that way, that these things are you know, practically set in stone for Assange?
Well, the other thing we should be concerned about, and Kronberg lays it out very clearly, is that Assange could be put in protective custody because he's a high-profile prisoner. And what that means is they get to do all sorts of things that they did to Chelsea Manning when she was first detained and was awaiting trial. You remember the international scandal that was sparked by her treatment at the Quantico Marine Brig, which has since been shut down. It actually does not exist. There are not people detained there anymore. And so, and in that facility, I remember they took her clothing away, they took her underwear away, they took, you know, they made her wear the suicide smock, which I saw displayed during the court-martial. I saw her put it on and demonstrate what it was like. It's just like itchy, uncomfortable thing that, like, nobody would be comfortable sleeping in, and especially in a prison. And they did this to her by twisting her words against her and reading into it the worst intentions. It was sarcasm, or she was talking about, you know, like, if you're going to do this to me, I could take the elastic in my waistband and I could do this with it. And then, just, I guess, to be a smart aleck, the military person who was overseeing her treatment decided, well, we need to take this seriously and take all of the clothing away. And when they called roll in the morning, she came out of her cell and she's completely naked. And everyone else has on what they're wearing in the prison. And everyone, you know, the people who are doing security for that prisoner, sort of like, why does this inmate not have any clothing on? She was treated like that as part of protective custody, the idea that they had to make sure no matter what, she survived and made it to her trial. Don't think they won't do the same thing to Julian Assange. They will say that they are putting him in restrictive conditions to protect his own safety in order to prevent him from doing anything to himself. They will take his mental health. They will use all of the worst claims that the defense has made to try and save him, and they will turn them against Julian Assange so that he is even more miserable, if you can believe it. And you may not think, how could you be more miserable? They will find a lower low that they can take this while he is in confinement.
So, Kevin, a lot of people ask you and me when we're covering this case, when we'll get a decision from the judges, where we think this is going. When you or I were talking last time, you pulled out this very big chart with all the possibilities of where Assange's judicial process could go. Could you maybe walk us through all these various outcomes?
Yes, so if you look down at the left part of the screen toward the middle, you'll see that it says the U.S. appeals to the High Court. That's where we are. We're also, I think there's another box that has U.S. appeals to the High Court, but that's not the same route. Anyways, if you go down to the bottom here, now where you're circling, there are three actions that can happen. The court can dismiss it. Well, then what's going to happen is the U.S. will appeal and it'll go before the Supreme Court. If it accepts these assurances, these diplomatic assurances that we do not find to be of any value, then it'll potentially go back down to the district court level. And so you basically go back to go, and you have a hearing before, I hope it would be a different judge and not Vanessa Beretzer, but I suppose things have been kind of bizarre already, so maybe she gets to have another crack at it. But again, I would think that it would be a different judge. It should be. And they would have a hearing on these assurances and discuss why the legal team for Assange would have a hearing much like the extradition hearing in September 2020. And they would say, look, you know, we're sorry we have to do this. We don't like being here. The U.S. should have put these forward a long time ago, but now they have. And we're here to put evidence and bring forward witnesses and say that we do not believe that these assurances should be taken seriously. And then the judge would review them and decide, based on those assurances, whether to reject the extradition request or not. And then the appeals continue, and we go back to the High Court for another hearing, and then we go back to the UK Supreme Court for another hearing. And then that's the last stage.
Kevin Gostola, thank you so much for your time and your brilliant reporting. Keep up the good work. It's a pleasure speaking with you. No date has been set by the judges on when they will hand down a decision, but they did say they were given a lot to think about. And I agree, there is a lot to think about. Namely, why is this entire hearing focusing on Assange's health? You know, we can now see very clearly why January's decision was a positive but an inadequate one. While the judge blocked the extradition, which is good, she only did it on health grounds. Meanwhile, the political charges, she agreed with them all. So right now, the whole discussion has shifted to Assange's health. You know, WikiLeaks published evidence of war crimes carried out by U.S. forces, intelligence agencies, and their allies. But instead of holding those politicians and soldiers accountable, the British justice system, at the behest of the United States, is putting Julian Assange on trial. And not just that, but his mental health on trial as well, reinforcing negative stigmas and stereotypes about mental illness. And when we talk about assurances, it's very important to point out the U.S. has broken promises it made to other prisoners many times before. They purposely word these things in a way that binds the prosecutors, but not the Department of Justice, which means they're useless because the Department of Justice is the only one who has the power to grant these assurances in the first place. Let's be clear on something. Even if Assange were in perfect health, he should not be extradited because it is the wrong thing to do. Even if the United States says it will place him in a five-star hotel, it's still not okay to extradite him for doing his job. What is happening here is unprecedented. This is a vendetta. It's a witch hunt against Assange because his journalism threatens the most powerful armies and governments on Earth. A journalist should not have to prove that they are sick and suicidal beyond hope just to avoid extradition to a foreign country they have no connection to. If Julian Assange is suicidal in the first place, it is because they have made him this way by persecuting him. He has been persecuted by the same government that now claims it will treat him well. I'm sorry, but if you think the United States is not going to lock up Julian Assange in some dark hellhole the moment he sets foot on U.S. soil, then you're really kidding yourself. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
The Limelight.
Democrats fear they are losing white swing voters over racial politics. Three studies suggest that the party's elite culture may be the real problem. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Ryan Grimm, writer. This article is published under the heading It's not just white people. Democrats are losing normal voters of all races. Here's more. Recently, a Democratic firm hosted focus groups with women in Virginia who voted in 2017 for Democratic Governor Ralph Northam, in 2020 for Democratic President Joe Biden, and then this month for Republican Governor-elect Glenn Youngkin. It was centered on suburban women, a group that pivoted significantly to the right in the governor's election. Consultant Danny Burfoot said that Anvil strategies called roughly 30,000 people in Virginia. Most didn't answer, but several hundred of them fit the criteria he was looking for.